Well, good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation in this, our 11th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague in the green back there, Peggy Wright, with assistance from Haiwan Wan, our website guru, taking pictures at the back here, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is the library's technology coordinator, David Runner. Our speaker tonight was born in North Carolina and grew up in Georgia, where he attended school and where his family still lives. Growing up, he wanted to be a mountain climber or a park ranger, and he was most influenced, he said, by reading adventure books and participating in the Boy Scouts. After graduating from high school, he attended Duke University, where he had studied history and environmental science. He said he became interested in geography because it was the only discipline broad enough to encompass all his interests. In 1994, he enrolled in the graduate program in geography at the University of Arizona, and after a year of traveling and living abroad in South America, received his PhD in 2002. His dissertation focused on the international utilization of shared water resources in the Colorado River Delta in Mexico. He has a JD in international law and a master's certificate in global ethics from the University of Georgia. And his articles on adaptation to climate change, global environmental change, and symptoms and effects of climate change appear in the award-winning Encyclopedia of Geography, published recently by SAGE in 2010. His research has examined the impact of climate change on natural resources and ecosystems in the Colorado River Delta of Mexico, in Chile, and in Bhutan. He's also an avid photographer and alpinist, and in 2009 received a Fulbright to study climate change in the Himalayas. While there, he worked with the Central Department of Botany at Nepal's National University, working on mountain conservation biology and climate change, which is one of his long-term interests. While in the Himalayas in 2010, he scaled the treacherous Northeast Ridge and reached the summit of Mount Everest at 29,035 feet, the world's highest mountain, on May the 23rd, 2010. His newest goal, he says, is to scale the highest point on each continent. Please give a warm welcome to WKU's intrepid explorer, John Aul.
Thanks. What I'm going to do today is basically walk you guys up Mount Everest, and I'm not going to make you suffer through the months of acclimatization and everything else that goes into it. You get the actual summit ride, so this is the good part. Because basically, with Mount Everest, it's at about 30,000 feet in elevation. And so you've got the upper atmosphere winds hitting it, and normally it's over 100 miles per hour up there. And you can't survive up there. No one can survive up there just for the cold and the wind. But once a year, when the monsoon flips from when the winds shift, let's just put it that way, there's about a 10-day window when those winds drop down to nothing and you can summit. And so everyone has to aim for that 10-day window to survive. Also, because it's at 30,000 feet, if anyone here, even me, was dropped from a helicopter at the summer, we'd be dead within 3 minutes. Your body there's no way to survive. Your body can't pull in enough oxygen. So you have to spend weeks climbing up and climbing down, climbing up a little further, climbing back down to recover, up a little further to adapt, down to recover. And again, so all that kind of went on in the background. Before this, I was sort of a blurry picture there, but I had my WKU hat. I was in Nepal, as he said, for a year working with the university there, so I was able to climb a lot of different mountains and go out into the field with students, so I was pretty well acclimatized before I got there. I was used to being at very high elevations. And so this is what Mount Everest looks like from the Nepal side. And typically they climb up around here on this ridge is the Nepal summit, the way to climb it. Let me go back here for a second. There's basically two ways in which you can try and climb it. The easy ways, there's the West Ridge, which is a lot harder. This is a historic route that in 1930s, Mallory and the rest of the British expeditions were trying to climb. And this is the Nepal route that was discovered in the late 1940s and finally climbed in the early 1950s. As you can see, it's a much shorter route, and it's a lot easier because you kind of cruise along here fairly low elevation, and then you gain all the elevation just in this little section. Whereas with the north side, you've got a lot of long distance here, slowly going higher and higher and higher. And at here and here, you're at the same elevation. So here, it's just a very short trip into the death zone. This is a much longer trip into the death zone. And so as a result, and a lot more people die. From on this south side, the year I did it, probably 500 people tried to do it, and maybe 300 did it. No one died. This north side, we had about 150 people try and do it. About 50 of them actually summited, and of those 50, 6 died on the descent. And about 10% death rate is fairly common, and historically that's the average death rate on the north side because you spend so much more time at elevation. And again, the reason is these horrible winds. When the storms brew on Mount Everest, it's a really unpleasant place to be. And again, you typically see these clouds overhead showing the very high winds. And again, you can't climb it during those time periods. So this is what you personally take. This is your personal gear that you need to survive. Huge thick down suit, you'll see that later. My sleeping bag I liken to a kayak, about this tall. Very warm, as you can imagine. Several pairs of boots and all different types of things, again, to survive. Again, my WKU hat. Unfortunately, it got up to 7,200 meters, went blowing off, and it flew like 5 miles straight down. So this is the border. I was coming overland from Nepal, and so this was the border of Tibet and China. So we've crossed over onto the Chinese side. It's Buddhist. The northern part of Nepal is Buddhist, the southern part is Hindu, and Tibet is Buddhist. So this is a Buddhist temple. You can see it's sort of rusted and run down looking, but that's kind of what they can do under given the conditions. The road zigzags up the valley, and it's fairly moist here. It's a little hard to see in this light, but there's still a lot of vegetation. As we went up and crested the ridge, then it becomes very dry. So we leave this moisture in Nepal behind. And so what you do is the first 3 days, we travel to a city. The border is at about 3,000 meters in elevation, so about 10,000 feet. And then every day we drive to another village or city and gain some elevation. So this one, it was about 4,000 meters in elevation. So we went here and spent 2 days. And you just sort of go there and let your lungs get used to it and everything else. And the first day I was here, I climbed up this ridge, up to here, and then back down. So this was sort of just a daily exercise to get used to the elevation. And then this is driving through Tibet. The road was built solely to climb Mount Everest. Everything else is just dirt roads, but you can see there's no plants, very harsh conditions in most of Tibet. This was our truck we brought with us. I was climbing with two other guys, a man from England and a man from Hong Kong. The guy from Hong Kong at advanced base camp went blind. The capillaries in his eyes started exploding, and so he went blind and had to go down. Fortunately, he did that. Another guy, one of the guys who died, had gone up to elevation. The capillaries started exploding in his eyes, but he's on the summit, so there was just no way to get him down. So anyway, there were three of us, and so it took a whole truckload of equipment to get three of us towards the mountain. This is, again, driving through Tibet, a lot of Buddhist prayer structures. That's Shishta Mang Pang Tang in the background. I apologize for my poor pronunciation of some of these mountains. But this is the only 8,000 meter peak only in China. It's a moderately difficult 8,000 meter peak. And again, just more of the Tibetan landscape. Most of the houses tend to be of this type, kind of a walled compounds, and they have livestock that stays in the walled compounds at night, and during the day goes out and grazes, although there's not much to graze in. So typical Tibetan houses on a very stark landscape. So there's Mount Everest. We're driving along the road. It's really cool. You can, oh, there it is. That's what we're going to climb. And this is the ridge. You end up, you can actually see the route. You go up this slope till we hit here, cruise along here to the summit, and back down. Of course, there's a lot more to it than that. But so again, driving along the road. Now here's Mount Everest again. Power lines. This is Choyoyo. This is one of the 8,000 meter peaks. That's its neighbor. We moved into, went into, however you pronounce that, National Preserve. Basically, the whole area of Tibet around Mount Everest is a gigantic national preserve. So this is the last town before we actually get, you know, sort of leave the road behind and everything. It's called Tingri. And this is, again, traditionally where the British and everyone else sort of base themselves out of. Common vehicle here, just this is a tractor connected to a wagon. Here's a motorcycle where they just welded on a thing to it. And then the more traditional mule carts, so the way people are getting around. This was your stores. You walked in and they had some Chinese-made goods, a couple of dried deer in the store for meat. Had a lot of windstorms blowing through, very windy most of the time. So this is looking, again, there's Everest over here. You can see the wind howling off the top there. Again, Choyoyo. So now we're moving into base camp. This is the last structure before you get to base camp. This is a monastery. It's called the Rombok Monastery. It's one of the more holy, almost most holy monasteries in Buddhism. And again, you can see the now Mount Everest a lot clearer. Again, we're going to kind of climb along here until we reach this point. Up here, climb back down. This is in the interior of that Rombok Monastery. It basically, the monastery itself is a cave, and one of the major Buddhist religious figures, Guru Rinpoche, and this is a little figure of him, he cruised into this cave and meditated here for 2 or 3 years, and he did this throughout the Himalayas, and so there's a lot of very sacred caves in Bhutan and Nepal and Tibet. And again, he was the one who really brought Buddhism down to Nepal and some of their places. So the actual base camp is guarded by the army. They don't want just anybody going and saying, well, I'm going to go climb Mount Everest. And so you have to, again, show your papers and everything else. And so now we've done all that sort of driving to here. So again, this is Mount Everest. So what the gate I just showed you is right about here. We drive through the gate, and we come up, and this is going to be our base camp. So from base camp, we go to an intermediate camp. I'll show you a picture of this later. From intermediate camp, we go up here to an advanced base camp. Advanced base camp, we go up to a ridge here, which is camp 1, camp 2, camp 3. In camp 3, we do a quick dash to the summit and back down. I have to stay in camp 2. Some people go lower, some people stay higher, and then come back around. So that's where we're going to be going. But you can see there's a lot of other Choyoyo, again, 8,000 meters, Makalu, 8,000 meters. A lot of huge mountains surrounding it. But again, when you get to the top of Everest, they just all look like little tiny hills. This is our base camp. Basically, with base camp, what you do is you go as far as you can. This is the old terminus of the Rombok Glacier. What happens with the glaciers is it's a huge, heavy piece of ice. And when it comes down a valley like this, it just pushes all the rock in front of it. So it leaves a dam behind. And that's what you see there is the rock dam at the end of the thing. So we just you build your camp right before you reach the dam. And basically in this camp, it's sunny in this picture. Every night it would snow, and then by about 2 in the afternoon it would be melted from the sun, and then it would snow again the next morning. So it was really rapid turnover. Because it's one of those things, again, it's 20 below at night and 80 degrees sometimes, and you're very close to the sun. This is basically, again, in order to acclimatize myself, what I would do is I'd climb up these walls on the valleys on either side. And so this is looking down on our base camp. Here's our 3 tents. Again, this is the guy who went blind, so we took his tent away. Those were our 2 tents. These prayer wheels are where the Buddhists put prayer flags up for each of the climbers to basically ask the mountain, ask for intercession with the mountain so that the mountain doesn't kill you. For good luck, I guess, is the best way to put it. So this was our little prayer wheel. And that was that's where we cooked our food and this is where we ate. Get out of the snow. So this is looking down on the Rombok Glacier. Back in the 1930s, when they were first trying to climb, this was all ice. And this is probably 4 miles, maybe. So you can see, again, there was ice to here. It was actually ice down in here as well. But now all this is melted, the glacier has, and right there is the limit of where you still have ice out close. And you can see the different colors of the ice of the water is showing you how much sediment in it, how rapidly it's been melting, and so forth. So, and again, this is looking down base camp. So there's some tents here. So I'm looking down on base camp. So this is what I did. Like I said, every day I would just climb up one of these ridges, come back down. The next day, climb up this ridge, come back down. So on, for exercise. To get to advanced base camp, you take yaks up. That's one of the reasons some people like this route is because you can take the yaks a little higher, and so it makes it easier and cheaper to climb. So now we're moving from base camp up towards intermediate camp. And again, this is about the level where you start to have some glacial ice. You can see these yaks are carrying massive loads. Here, me and the yak facing off, who gets the trail? I ended up winning. So this is the intermediate camp. Basically, this is rock about this deep, and there's ice underneath it. So the rock is insulating the glacier. It's not melting quite as quickly. You can see this edge right here. This is where the glacier was back in the 1930s. It's come up here, and it was a much more difficult climb at the time. Now all that's left are these little serrats here. I can't even pronounce anything. Little ice towers scattered throughout. Again, this is another look at the intermediate camp. You can see the tents. And so with these seracs, you're worried about them falling, obviously. But fortunately, that one was sort of angled the other direction. So that's one of the things you have to worry about moving through. So this is, I'm standing on one edge of the glacier, and this is the other edge, and this is where it's melted away. So these are yaks going down the glacier, and then you can see people going up the other side to give you a sense of scale. So massive, massive location that we're at throughout. So again, now we're leaving, I'm standing at intermediate camp, and now we're beginning to climb up onto the glacier towards advanced base camp. Again, looking down at the yaks, now trying to cross that big valley. So now this is, again, walking up. You can see Everest even closer. We can begin to see the three steps. And historically, it's a nice clean ridge, but if you look at it, there's an undulation here, which is like a stair step, and an undulation here, which is a stair step, and an undulation here, which is a stair step. And the second step is past vertical, and it's one of those things that basically, when they were climbing, they were like, how can we get around that? That's one of the questions about whether or not that was what actually killed Mallory. So those are some of your obstacles. Again, what we're going to do is we're going to climb up to here, camp 2, camp 3, summit, back down. So again, walking along the edge of the glacier, the path goes along here, skirts along the edge of here on the rock. You can see trying to walk through there, it's not really feasible. So again, walking through the seracs and everything. So now we've made it up to advanced base camp. Now it's only about this deep now with the rock. So you're actually sleeping on the ice the whole time. This was one of the big camps. There's a lot of people with a lot of money who've climbed this. They pay like $50,000 and so forth. Fortunately, I was able to go at cost because I was working with some of the locals and so forth. This is how you get water every day. Just take an axe out and chop off a piece of the glacier and melt it. So kind of a time-consuming thing. So again, you're living on ice. You can see the ice down here where you're standing. So we just get some rocks, put the stoves on top of that so they don't melt their way into the ice. And that's where you cook for the next couple months. So this, again, is looking down at base camp. You can see we're, again, right next to the edge of the glacier. These are the big rich people with the huge tents and everything. And then this is our little camp, a little more Spartan. My tent's the one actually on the ice. I drew the love straw, I guess. So this is the true northeast ridge, but it's a very difficult climb, so we actually kind of bypass around that. So there's one of our tents and our little northeast ridge. There's my tent. And again, every day with snow, it would melt. Some days it would melt, some days it wouldn't. So this was actually after 2 days in a row that it snowed and not melted. And then, you know, you go back the next day and there's no snow at all. So you can see no snow, snow, and then no snow and so forth. I'm actually sitting there in the tent, which you can't really see. Again, now we're back to no snow again. So here's the suit that we had to wear. I was just trying it on at this point to see how it fits. And you can see it's just a massive, massive thing. Testing the oxygen out. This was our typical meal. We had fried Spam and cabbage, boiled cabbage, and then Spam in a roll, and then lots and lots of things to drink because dehydration is your major concern as you're climbing. So now this is a little closer looking at the actual camps and so forth. So again, base camp was way back here. We walked around the mountain
and came to Advanced Base Camp, which is where we're at here at the foot. Now we're going to climb up to this col, the North Col, and oh, good, it's massive feet. I was doing meters, so I don't know what it is. It's 23,000 feet, 7,000 meters, 7,050 meters. So Camp 1 is right in this col, and again, I'll show you it later. Then you go up to the top of the snow, and that's going to be Camp 2. Then you go up to Camp 3. Most people don't use Camp 4 because they tended to die there. And so they said, well, it's probably better avoid that. And then we've got the first step, second step, the third step. And then again, you dash up to the summit and come back down. Again, you typically sleep a few hours here, summit, and then back down to here or down to here, depending on what the weather's doing and so forth.
And there just is another picture of it. Again, you can see how steep the second step is. Major obstacle to get through. So here I'm about ready to take off. Yeah, it's difficult to see with this light. So now we're actually walking from Advanced Base Camp towards the North Col. Col means pass. So the camp is up in here, and we just have to get here. So you start out on a nice flat glacier, and you're going to hit this ridge that you have to climb a little closer. In the past, the first day, few days I was here, we climbed up like this, one like this. We crossed here, climbed up, and then the actual camp's right here. The problem was, after we'd been there a week or two, a bunch of guys got swept away by an avalanche here, so we decided we didn't want to go that way. So then we crossed this way, now we go up this way around, and try to avoid more of the avoid the real bad avalanche. Again, you've got some avalanche risk right there, but it's not as bad.
It's one of those things that it sounds kind of weird, but we actually, one of the guys who was with us, I told you the one guy went blind. Well, the guy who was supposed to climb with him, the Sherpa, his appendix burst because of the altitude. And so it was horrible, and we were taking care of him, but if we hadn't been taking care of him, we were scheduled to be right here when the avalanche hit. So and it took 30 Sherpas and us to get the guy down to the thing. So basically we said, thank God your appendix burst, because he actually lived. It sort of surprised everybody because it was such a long way to get into hospital care. And he lived, and so we were all like, thank you, you saved like 35 people by having your appendix burst. Because if not, we'd all been there and all been swept away. So again, there's just a close-up of the actual climb. A close-up different angle of it. So a really steep, icy section, as you can see. Coming up. So this is pretty vertical. So you've got a lot of glaciers to cross. You usually use ladders. You stake the ladders in. You clip yourself to a rope going across it to try and balance on it.
It looks really easy in the pictures, but it's not
nearly that easy because you're wearing crampons and boots and everything, and the ropes are real loose. So it's not nearly as easy as it looks. So this is now I'm partially up that ice wall. So here's Advanced Base Camp. And what we did was we walked along to here, cruised along here, like this. This brown streak is where the glacier's melting. So again, this is at 22,000 feet. Some of the very few places anywhere on Earth are this high. And the ice is melting. And so yeah, if you see on the news, they say, well, the Himalayan glaciers aren't melting. I mean, they're melting. There's no question. So again, you've got this long walk across that flat part of the glacier. So this is looking down at Camp 1. So Camp 1 is in the peak, the pass right here. Again, we climb up this to get to Camp 1, and then from Camp 1, you come across here and then walk up to where I'm at. So now I'm standing at about 26,000 feet, looking down at Camp 1. But I just wanted you to get a sense of where it's at. So now this is the actual climb up the up that ice wall to get to Camp 1. And you can see some people are carrying some big loads. A lot of Sherpas had to carry it for the rich people. And the rich people had these mats. And down at base camp, they actually had a plasma TV. Mind-boggling. Well, and the thing that's sad is they have all that stuff, and so they sit in the tent, and they don't do anything. And there were 22 people in the party next to us, and only three of them summited because they weren't in shape. They'd sat in their tents thinking, well, we're getting in shape, whereas you know I was climbing the mountains on either side. And it makes a big difference. Get too comfortable. Again, here's crossing some of the crevasses, big loads on. So now this is up at Camp 1. Again, that picture I showed you looking down on it was from on the ski slope. So basically from here, we're gonna go up the ski slope. Camp 2 will be right here. And then up here, this blizzard is Camp 3. But again, the summit's almost always in blizzard.
It's just rarely that these areas down below you can actually do anything.
Actually, it was kind of weird. One of these days we came up here, it was a day like this, and there was a tent right here, and we were all sort of standing there, and all of a sudden it just goes, and just blew away. It was filled with sleeping bag, backpack, all kinds of stuff. And the guy was like, no! Because, I mean, his climb was done, you know? His tent's gone, his backpack's gone, all his gear's gone. He just had to turn around and leave. And it's amazing. It's really, really amazing. So, again, this is Camp 1. We're hiding from the wind. There's a huge wind that blows off. Again, this is where my WKU hat went this way. This is right through that pass, so we're hiding behind it on this rock wall, or this snow wall. So again, another picture of the Camp 1. So we built our tent, and then we went down to rest, and then we went back up a few days later, and our tent was crushed. The snow, as you can see, the seam burst, and the snow had crushed the tent, which, again, you can see this tent's ripped open, all the stuff. So yeah, these blizzards just kind of come through and destroy everything, and if you're lucky, you're down low, and so you don't get killed or frostbite or anything. So here we just had to dig our tent back out. All our stuff's kind of scattered hither and yon. So from Camp 1, again, you move up this ski slope, and that literally is what it is. It's about the steepness of something like a Black Diamond ski slope. You know, it's about 8 feet steep, so. And again, it's just a slow walk where your heart's pounding and everything else. This is looking down again at Advanced Base Camp. So we walked from Advanced Base Camp, walked along here. So one nice thing about this climb, you get lots of bird's eye view of where you've been. And this is again Camp 1 from up to, I think I'm up on Camp 2 now. You can see just how high you're moving. This peak that I'm about equal with is like 7,600 meters. Is 26,000 feet, and so we're about even with that now. So this is just right before you get to Camp 2. You can see climbing up the rope through this broken rock. Again, this is just above that snow field, and this is Camp 2 from a distance. And you might be looking at that going, well, how do you put the tent down? It doesn't look very comfortable. And it's not. I mean, it's broken, sharp, pointy rock. I actually brought a rock so you guys could see what the, this is from the summit. And you'll see it's sharp, very, very sharp. And that's all this rock has been frost broken over and over and over again. And so, yeah, it's really horribly uncomfortable to sleep on. And basically what you do is you find a relatively flat spot, and if you're lucky, some other expedition's tent's been destroyed, and you use their tent as padding for your tent. And so that's how you do it. So again, that's Camp 2. This is at 7,600 meters, which is like 26,000 feet or something. So now we're really high. This is about as high as you go for training. So again, you move up, you move down, you move up and move down. 8,000 meters, 7,500 meters, about in there is the death zone. Anytime you're above that, I try to explain it to people, it's like you're Frosty the Snowman and you're melting. You can feel every cell in your body dying. You can feel them all just, I don't know how to describe it, you just know you're dying. And that's what you feel like once you reach, again, Camp 2. Camp 2 on it just becomes really miserable. Yeah, this guy's tent's destroyed. He's looking at kind of bummed. And so again, when your tent's destroyed, you lose a pack, you lose anything, you're down. You're done. You have to leave. And so again, he would leave and pop our tent down on top of it. Most of the time, you tie your tents down with climbing rope and other sorts of things to keep them in place, to keep them from getting shredded like that. So this is our set of tents. Again, you can see we're kind of locked down. That was my guy I was climbing with from England. So that's our Camp 2. You might be looking at the tents going, aren't those kind of sloped? Yes, they're very sloped. But again, that was just kind of the best thing you could do. And they are, it's not full tent length. I think it was about, we had about a 5.5 foot straight flat-ish section to sleep on. But the views are spectacular. Yeah, you said you did Calipatar.
Right there.
High when I was there.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
You get there. I was high near there.
Yeah. Well, no, I did Calipatar as well, and you're like, oh, wow, this is really hard. And you look down, it's like, oh, my goodness. That's nothing. And so that 8,000-meter peak Troyoyo I was talking about, that's it right there. So you can see we're pretty close to its summit. And we're just at Camp 2, a long, long way from the top. So here we're eating some dehydrated food. So now this is from Camp 2 looking up towards Camp 3.
The problem is there's this big cliff in our way. So what you've got to do is you've got to climb up the rock, skirt around until you reach the edge of it, and then kind of skirt back around. That's the actual summit right there, so we're getting closer. And again, this is one of those weird things. I'm over 8,000 meters. I started using the oxygen at 8,000 meters. So I'm up in the death zone, and I'm bare hands and a t-shirt on. It's that hot. It's one of those greenhouse effect things where the sun is just cooking you. And then the second it stops cooking you, it's 40 below. You're dying. But again, so what we're going to do is we're going to cross. Over here, you can see there's a climber out there, climbing around there. And again, there's the summit. It's getting closer and closer. So again, some climbers moving through these rock bands. So this little weakness, that's what you have to do is look for these weaknesses. Climb through and punch through the cliffs to keep moving upward. And again, the problem is you're doing all this heavy, strenuous climbing over 8,000 meters. And that's what makes it so deadly, is because you just are exerting so much. Again, if the light was a little better, you could see it's really steep. Now it's gotten cold again. You can see the wind starting to blow off the summit. So it's getting dangerous up there. You want to hit the summit as early in the morning as you can. And again, this is what scared the British so much. They would get up to this point, and they would see the second step and say, you know, that's a ship prow. How am I going to climb that? And so then they would try and traverse along here, or some of them went up there. This is the third step, the second step. So you've got to climb these two things on your way up, and then you climb up this, circle around like that, and get to the summit. So now we've gotten up to Camp 3. Same sort of thing. There's a lot of Rex tents that you use as your tent platforms. This one was even smaller. It was probably 4.5 feet of length we had. You kind of had to curl up. Fortunately, you only spend about 8 hours here or less. So basically, you just get there, sleep, melt water, and take off. The other thing that's kind of weird about this place is there's a lot of bodies here. Once you get above 8,000 meters, when you die, they can't do anything about it. And I'm not going to point them out, but in this picture, there's bodies. And so it's one of those things that it's kind of eerie as you go along. All the pictures I'm going to show you guys, there's bodies throughout, and it's really, really disturbing when you're actually climbing. That was the thing that really shocked me the most, was seeing all the bodies. Again, you can see the very, very steep angle. The tents, there's a lot fewer tents here. Hardly anyone's made it to this point. But at the same time, you know, we're really, really high up. This is 8,300 meters, so 27,000 feet or something. No snow. All the snow is melted away or sublimated away because the temperature is so warm at this point. Coming in, you can see this guy's got his hat off. You're almost out of the atmosphere, but yet it's still warm enough that you're not cold. So this is just kind of sitting there in the tent, relaxing. Like I said, you get there and you have about 8 hours to sort of relax and rest. So looking back down. So this is that peak that was 7,600 meters. It looks so monstrous. Camp 1 is right there. Long, long way down. And getting towards sunset. Very, very steep slopes we're camped on. I'm miserable. So again, this is Camp 3. Down there. Kind of trying to rest and relax. And this is so cool because you just open the tent door and there's the summit right there. All you have to do is go up there and back. So again, it gets dark. And so what we do is from Camp 3, we leave at about 9 p.m. Because what you want to do, you leave at 9 p.m. so that you can time it and arrive right at sunset. Because you know as the sun goes up, those winds increase and get worse and worse and worse. And so you've got, again, a limited window during the day in which you can summit. So this is sitting there in the tent blowing up the actual summit. You can again see the third step we got to climb. Once you climb that, you traverse along here, climb up to here, go along here, then you zigzag back, and then you zigzag back to the top. So this is moving along the ridge. Again, since I left at 9 at night, I didn't obviously take any pictures. So I took the pictures going down and then reorganized them. So that's why they are all looking down. Most of them are looking down. So once you reach the ridge, you traverse around, and basically right now I'm on the first step. So if you remember where the first step was, we're trying to get up and around the first step. So you can see it's, again, kind of tweaky rope climbing. There's a lot of rope that other parties have left. Most of them are rotten, and you clip to them, and they'll just break under your carabiner. This one looks fairly new, so sometimes there was new stuff. You just didn't know what was there. And again, you sort of trusted it, you sort of didn't. This is actually climbing the first step, which is fairly easy. It's about 5'3", you know, rock climbing ratings. And again, from that first step, this is looking back down. So camp two is right here. Camp one is right here, that little yellow blob. And base camp is right here. So you get these nice views back. And this was that path. Remember, we walked along between the seracs? So this was the path we took up from intermediate camps here. But again, you get these great views. It's like you're in an airplane. So this is the second step. This is the one, the kind of the death step that people come to and don't tend to survive. It's really eerie because you're kind of making this, see there's like this flat platform, and you have to kind of step and then balance like this. And when you're doing the balance, there's a dead body right there, off your feet. And he's tied into the rope. So you know, well, even if I fall, I've got the rope on, it doesn't matter. And like I said, it was really, really kind of freaks you out a little bit. So this is looking down the second step. Again, you kind of come up here, traverse along sideways, and you have to climb up this little section. So again, that's the second step. Then once you've done all that, you climb up this, do a snowshoe. And then this is the part that is supposed to be unclimbable. And so the Chinese, when they did the first ascent, brought a ladder. Since then, they brought several iterations of the ladder and made it better and better. It's one of those things that rock climbing wise, it's not that horrible. 5, 10 maybe. But yeah, you're at that elevation. And this is the rock. It's crumbly, crappy. It's just going to fall apart in your hand. So again, it's, you know, that the people always say, well, did Mallory make it? Did he not make it? I know he didn't climb this rock. It's just way too crumbly. He might have done this crack in the corner. But again, just very, very difficult conditions to climb. So this is looking down the full third step, or second step. Again, you can see somebody coming off the snowshoe. So you got the snowshoe back down and out. Pretty difficult. It's definitely a really difficult thing. So from there, it's a nice flat walk. You got a little, from there, it's a little bit of a nice flat walk. You're like, oh, this is great. And then you come up to the third step. Or this is looking back down. So you can see the second step was down here. So what we did was, here's camp three. We climbed up till we hit the ridge. And the thing that's cool about this ridge is from here, it's about this angle. So it's steep, but not that bad. This side, it's straight down 15,000 feet. Over 3 vertical miles straight down. You can throw a rock 3 miles. Nowhere else on earth can you throw a rock 3 miles. And so, yeah, you just walk along the edge of that the whole way. So again, there's a blow up of the camp three. So now from here, you can see the summit, and it's getting close, and you're feeling good. Well, of course, all you saw was lights. I forgot it was dark. So this is the third step. Again, this is kind of eerie because I went up to it, and this is the third step. And so you come up to it, and there's a snow field here, and then there's a step. And you think, well, should I go this way or this way? And again, I was going to ask this guy, because I said, oh, look, there's a Sherpa there sitting there. I wonder what he's doing. Well, let me just go ask him.
Yeah,
and then you realize he's dead, and so I didn't want to go that way. So you just end up climbing up and going around. So again, you come up, you see skirting around there. So this is the thing, and you can see why I didn't want to climb it. You look at it, it's like, whoa, hey, that's kind of tough at 8,700 meters. So you're almost at the summit at that point. So now this is up on top of it, looking down. You can see it's, again, sort of a knife edge, a red 15,000 feet drop that way. And so you're just climbing along this ridge. And so then again, you get here, and this is that little last snow field that you have to climb. Get up to the top. So there's a body there. So now I'm actually on that snow field climbing up. And you can, again, see that 15,000 foot drop. You're just rocking right along the edge of it. It's really amazing. And so again, looking back down, this is that huge peak that we were looking at, you know, above us and then beside us, and now it's just this little tiny thing. And base camp's way down there. Advanced base camp's here. Camp one, sort of see there. So now we're almost at the summit. This is the first daylight that I saw. So this is the first picture I took on the actual ascent. This is at the top of that snowfield. Now I said you got to traverse along. So you're traversing along like this, on the, through this rock until you get here. At this point, I met a team carrying a guy down who was kind of unconscious, but he was sort of semi-conscious. They were guiding him down, so it actually wasn't that bad. And again, you're looking, these are some, this is Nepal you're looking at, some 8,000 meter peaks. So now there's the summit. I'm so close. Just a little bit of snow, undulation to get up there. I'm getting close. All this is all the moisture that was in my body. So at this point, I'm incredibly dehydrated because every time I breathed out, it immediately condensed on my jacket and so forth. But you can see I'm getting hot. I had to open everything up. So again, it's amazing the temperature things there. Flags from prayer flags. You can see the sky. If the light was better, you can see the sky's black. You can see the curvature of the earth from there. The light does really weird things at this point. So now I'm looking back down on the route. So this is the ridge I just climbed up. It's up here all the way down, Camp 3, Camp 2, Camp 1, and so on. That's all Nepal, all Tibet spread out below me. So there's up on the summit. You can see these guys don't look like they're in very good shape at all. Most of them have come from the south side. So on our side, I think 15 people maybe summited my day. But again, everyone brings up prayer flags and so forth, and you put them all up there. So this was the picture that they airbrushed on the thing. They wanted some more mountains in the back. They said, oh, this is good enough. So they took some of my mountains. This is looking down again towards Nepal. So this is the Nepal side. You can see it's kind of snowy mountains. The Tibet side is that deserty. So this is Choyoyo, the one we talked about.
Kalpatar,
I think it's this thing.
Yeah, and then
Ahmadabad
is over there.
Yeah, this is Ahmadabad right there.
Yeah.
Or no, not Ahmadabad,
Pumori. Pumori there. See, yeah, Kalpatar is just below Pumori.
Yep, it's that little...
Or is 22.3.
Notch.
It's like the same as, a little higher than Kent.
Yeah, and again, so that's Choyoyo, which is the other 8,000 meters. So it's really pretty. Yeah, actually, Kamal and my dad, a bunch of people have done Kalpatar. So Kamal, see, that's what you did.
Yeah.
This is Makalu, which is the fourth highest peak in the world, I think. Again, kind of looking down on it. And that's Kanchenjunga. Kanchenjunga. So this is on the border with India. So that's the Indian border. Kanchenjunga, third highest peak. Makalu is the fourth highest peak.
That was from the summit, right?
Yeah, it's from the summit. This, again, is Kalpatar, looking down from the summit. This is Lhotse, which is the second highest peak in the world. Again, still looking quite a ways down at it. This is the Nepal route. So the Nepal route, what it does is it cruises through this valley, and then you come up to this col much higher, and then you just come up the ridge. So it's a much shorter, steeper route. So that's
the climbers
Nepal
that side. Picture, it doesn't look like there's
Yeah. Expect there. Oh, I'm sorry. It's
yeah, right. But, yeah, see, this
you
is
expect to see those guys in the South Kamal.
It faces south, and what happens is on this side it's snow, and on this side it's overhung. Right. So if you step here, it breaks.
See ya.
You go 15,000 feet. Which is actually why there's a lot fewer bodies on this route, because when people get lost, they just walk slightly left.
A long way down.
Yeah. So this is, I walked down to the Nepal side for a while because I wanted to cross the border illegally. And so now I'm taking pictures. This is the Nepal climbers, and you see they're kind of having a dance, and everybody's excited and happy to be at the summit. And then this is just looking at the piles of prayer flags. This is a little Buddha box, another little Buddha here, but the box got filled with snow. And most of this stuff, the 100-mile-an-hour winds when they come back, is just going to blow it all away. That's what the summit looks like. So people ask me, well, you've got the mask on. What did you look like? Well, that's what you look like. You see why I'm wearing the mask. You're definitely not in the best physical condition of your life at that point. So I got really lucky because I'm just crossed. Well, this is the third step. So I'm down on the second step, and this blizzard starts blowing in. And this blizzard came in, and no one saw the summit again. Two or three other parties actually successfully summited. Several people went up there and died. Most of the people who died in this blizzard trying to summit the day after I did. So
we had the last summit, and it was perfect. You saw the visibility. I mean, that's stunning, stunning. Really, really, really lucky. And again, so the clouds are coming in. I just made it just to Camp 3 as the blizzard started. And then the whole rest of the way, I literally couldn't see you guys. The snow was that bad. And I would step in a crevasse, but I had so much weight on, I would do like a total front flip over the crevasse, land on the other side, and what happened? And just keep moving. So then we went back down, broke up camp. That's what I looked like. This is like after a couple days of recovery. And that's what the Tibetan government gives you to signify that you climbed 48.13 meters in elevation. And then that's just what it looks like in base camp. So that's the climb. So it looks like I left perfect amount of time for questions. Any questions?
Questions?
Uh-huh.
What about radiation burns? Do you have protection on your face most of the time?
SPF 70. Did you give me 100? Did you send 102 or just 70? I think it was 100. I had the best SPF you could get. And yeah, I was really, really well tanned. Actually, I had a couple things on my face that were just, it burned past sunburn. But fortunately, they healed pretty well. So, but yeah, it was devastating.
Did you have guides who tell you where to go?
No, what we did was we had a couple, you have to have somebody with you, a Sherpa with you. And so they would sort of go to camp with us, and then we would climb ourselves. But there was just so many other people going, and it's fairly obvious where you had to go. And it's, like I said, it was 15,000 foot this way, 12,000 foot this way, and kind of a narrow pass. So you didn't have too many choices.
You said the glacier was melting. What's the amount per year?
Oh, who knows? Like I said, it's so much of it's disappeared. It's really hard to say, but it's amazing. You read these stories. I was talking to some of the people who had tried to climb in the 70s, and they were talking about, yeah, we would, on base camp, which now is rock, no ice anywhere. They were talking about, yeah, we had these like 30-foot crevasses, and we would just throw trash into them. And 30-foot of ice, at least, has disappeared since the 70s. And again, when you read the old historic accounts in the 30s, yeah, there was hundreds of feet of ice. And now, and this is, again, at 19,000 feet. And it's all gone. It's just stunning, stunning.
So what happened to Mallory?
See?
Not his body. At the yellow band just blowed big stuff.
Yeah, he fell.
With a broken leg and a broken shoulder.
See, that's the thing. When you go to, let's go back to the
ship's problem. Showed it really well.
Yeah, the third step. Oh, one thing, you were asking about the glacier melting. The thing that was weirdest was we set up our tent, so the tent insulates the glacier from the snow. And over the 5 weeks we were there, the tent didn't move, and the ground melted away from us almost 3 feet, almost a full meter. It was, I had to step up to my tent this high. So that much of the glacier melted with rock on top of it. So yeah, we literally, most of the days when I wasn't hiking, we spent building drainage ditches. I didn't bring any pictures of those because I figured they'd be boring. But that's what we would do with an ice axe, is try and drain the water away from our tents because the whole hill slope was melted.
Go back.
Again, the problem with Mallory, because he tried the second step, so that's the third step. So it would have been, oh, it's looking down the second step.
Yeah.
So again, he either had to do this or this. And I'd always heard that this crack is about 5'10". Conrad Anker, the guy who found Mallory's body, said, oh, it's about 5'10". But several other people I've read said, no, if you are used to climbing in Scotland, that's 5'6", which is a fairly easy climb. And, if you're in good shape, you can do it. And when I got there, yeah, it looked much more 5'6". With the light, you can't see it, but it's a fist crack. It's an easy crack to climb.
But you took the ladder.
Of course.
I mean, the Chinese placed that ladder, right?
No, this one was replaced after the Olympics.
Oh, really?
During the Olympics, they wanted to take the flag to the summit.
It crossed the summit.
And according to all the Sherpas, like 30 Chinese climbers died because they kept trying to take it up into the storm. The government was like, take the flag out. You know, we need the thing up there. And they would go up there and a storm would hit them and just kill everybody. So according to the Chinese government, no one died.
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, they put the big ladder up for that.
Anyway, so about Mallory, you were talking.
Yeah, so, and that's what people said. There's, if it's 5'10", there's no way he's climbing it. This, I think he can probably climb it. So when I read Conrad Anker's thing, it was like, no chance, you know, 10% if it's 5'10". Looking at it and climbing it, yeah, I would give him at least 50% chance of gotten up it.
When Hillary goes up, which
probably he's on the other side, the easy side. Yeah.
On the easy side.
Yeah, so he just sort of, it's a little snow, a little snow. There's one step that you have to cross, which is the Hillary step. Yeah. And then it's
about 30 feet.
Yeah. So it's much simpler. Nothing like this, and certainly nothing like this, so this sort of sustained amount.
Yeah, talk a bit about your work and what you've been up to in the fall and what you're involved with in the fall.
Well, basically what we were trying to, I was working with the Department of Botany, and what we wanted to do was look at how biodiversity is being affected by climate change, because with the glaciers are melting, it's so much warmer there, it's just incredible. And so species are moving in, and I wanted to go, and we took data all over the place. But the problem is people are moving in as well as species. So it's warmer, people don't have to go down. You know, it used to be that they only spent 2 or 3 months up there, now they can spend 3 or 4 months up there, and their yaks can spend 3 or 4 months up there, and their sheep can spend 3 or 4 months up there. So it's really difficult to tell. I mean, you can see everything's growing better, but in terms of actually measuring it, the sheep are eating it before I can, you know, I use satellite remote sensing, so I take aerial, you know, pictures, but you're taking pictures of grazed land effectively. So I was really disappointed that whenever you've got resources, they're being extracted, unfortunately. And even in parts, because the monarchy in Nepal ended, and the monarchy kept good control over the parks. They protected them. And when that ended, it's effectively now sort of an anarchy. They're writing a constitution, but everyone's just making as much money as they can, as quickly as they can. So as a result, no one's really protecting the parks. We would interview guys, and they were like, so, you know, where's the park superintendent? Oh, he's never been here. He lives in Nepal. He just kind of gets his money every once in a while, and, you know, none of the park personnel had ever been in these parks. And so the only people in them are the yaks and the sheep. So it.
John, was the breathing on the descent as bad as on the ascent?
To be honest, that's the other thing I didn't mention. I mean, at this elevation, even after all those climbs I'd been doing to acclimatize, you know, I'm at 6,000 meters shooting up the side of hills like there's nothing to it. But even there, I mean, you're just delirious. You know, I was in great, great, great shape. I'm delirious. It's like you're dead drunk or something. And so on the descent, not only was I dead drunk, but I was completely dehydrated, and I'd been on the go for about 20 hours, and so I don't remember anything about it. You know, it's basically, I got down, and I sort of remember falling, like I said, in crevasses and stuff, and climbing out of them, and the long, slow snow slope, I guess it's way back there. But you guys remember that snow slope? I basically got there and was just exhausted. The snow was everywhere. So I just sat on my butt and started sliding down it. And whenever I would go too close to the edge, it was kind of like, oh, this isn't good. And I put my ice axe down and stop. And then I would move back to the center of it and start sliding again. Because I had read where one of the British guys did it. He was like, oh, yeah, I descended from Camp 1 to Camp 2, and or Camp 2 to Camp 1 in 12 minutes. I was like, oh, that sounds great. I'm going to do that. So the whole time I'm just like going right to the edge and stopping and moving back over. And I get down, and they're like, you idiot, you did that. What if you had gone over the edge? I was like, it just never occurred to you. You know, I mean, you're looking down going, well, it just, like I said, your brain just doesn't work. The only reason I remember to get this rock is because my brother said, whatever you do, be sure to get some rocks. And otherwise, it's one of those things that clicked because he said it. If I had been trying to remember it, I wouldn't have remembered it. I was taking video on the summit. I take this great panoramic video, and I start another one, and then the camera just goes like this because I forgot I was taking video. And then I was like, oh, what am I doing? I turned it off, and I never took any more. Really bizarre how your mind works up there.
So. How long did the total from the very base to the summit take?
Again, once I was acclimatized and once we started the thing, it's normally it was a day between each camp. But we skipped intermediate camp on the way for the actual summit bid. So it's to a base camp was 1 day, rest of the day, then advanced base camp to camp 1, camp 1 to camp 2, camp 2 to camp 3. Camp 3 to summit and back to camp 2, camp 2 back to the thing, so 7 days, a week. And that's active, I mean, moving, like I said, 23 hours for the summit day. So,
so So skill and a good bit of luck, I guess, getting up to the top there.
Oh, yeah. You know, and that's, unfortunately, that's a lot of the guys who died. They just, you know, it's bad luck.
What's your bad day?
Yeah.
Well, John, I don't know how to talk to you because you had wowed me this entire night. I was on the edge of
dumbfounded.
My
you, you mean?
And this would not have survived had you had it at the top of the mountain and it's heavy. But anyway, we just want to say thank you. This was
thank
wonderful.
You, ma'am. I appreciate it. Very nice.
Thank you, ma'am.
Well, on behalf of WKU Libraries and our friends organization, our congenial hosts here at Barnes & Noble, again, John, many thanks for an extraordinary story, one of the most extraordinary we've heard in 11 years.
Yes.
We want to thank you all for coming out. We hope you'll join us again on April 7th when Jana McMahon, a noted Southern novelist, will be joining us from South Carolina. And then again on the 21st when James Sickmeyer will be talking about recent history, turbulent history in Bolivia, and about his new book to be published by Penn State. So thank you all very much for coming out and have a good evening.
Thank you. And again, I got The Rock up here if anybody wants to see
The Rock. Thanks so much.